This is 89.9 WWNO New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll share a story from our coastal desk, learn how to right the wrong together within our community, and APM's host of A Prairie Home Companion, Chris Thiele, makes a quick stop in the city. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. Multiple Grammy Award winner and MacArthur Fellow Chris Thiele is in New Orleans. The mandolinist and member of Nickel Creek and the Punch Brothers wowed a special crowd last night at the Jazz and Heritage Center, but stopped by before continuing his tour. Chris Thiele, welcome to New Orleans.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I love this place.
I can tell.
I love it here.
You're into so much these days. Let's talk about your role as the newest host of A Prairie Home Companion.
This is a very exciting adventure for me. Definitely one of the most intense experiences I've ever had in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, because you've been on the show throughout your career several times.
That's true. Hosting it is a different matter entirely. Certainly appearing on the show, Garrison's whole, for the uninitiated, Garrison Keillor was the longtime host of Prairie Home Companion before I took over.
Yeah.
Garrison has been a tremendous influence on me, not just because of the music that he had on the show, but actually his entire audience engagement MO, just speaking to people. And when he came out to Portland, Oregon, which is where I was living at the time, to pitch me on the idea of becoming the next host,
yeah.
he talked about the importance of speaking to people and how necessary that is, particularly now when people are being spoken to less and less, and you know, being texted at more, tweeted at, and all of that. There's a three-dimensionality to the actual human voice,
yeah.
An aural three-dimensionality that is so refreshing, particularly now. So to get to present music and comedy in that context has been a real joy.
Yeah, and it seems, from what I hear, it seems like you're really enjoying it.
I'm having the time of my life. No joke.
So you have a new project out in collaboration with pianist Brad Meldahl. Can you share some magical moments during that recording process?
So many. I think for me, something that stands out would be just losing myself in the midst of a take,
you know,
in the recording studio. It's hard to do that. There are all these, like we're experiencing right now, there are all these microphones, you know, in your face, in front of your instrument. It's hard to lose sight of what you're doing, which is, you know, okay, we got to get this take. We got to do it right. We got to do it. Red lights on. Here we go.
Right.
But I found myself just kind of hovering above the experience so frequently,
mm-hmm.
due to my sheer appreciation of his musicianship,
yeah.
of Brad's musicianship. He's such a tremendous musician, pianist, that you know, I could be in the middle of a vocal take and just not even be paying attention in the slightest to what I was doing, but just listening to him.
But as I listen, I hear a friendship through the music. Am I correct in that observation?
Absolutely. I think we didn't know, you know, we basically started playing music together before we hardly said hello. So,
wow.
So it was a friendship born of a musical connection,
mm-hmm.
and I like that kind of friendship a lot.
Yeah.
I hope you do hear that.
Now, here are some interesting facts. You've been playing the mandolin since you were 2 years old, and at age 7, you performed your first paid gig. At that age, talk about the role your parents played in your career.
Oh, they played a tremendous role in my career. Although I can't quite take credit for starting at 2. I started asking them for a mandolin when I was 2.
Okay.
They didn't relent until I was 5. Sadly, they didn't take me 100% seriously until I was 5, because I was also, you know, in addition to asking for a mandolin, I was asking if I could be, you know, Shamu the killer whale when I grew up, or a train, a locomotive, you know,
yeah.
can I be a train when I grow up?
So they said, hey, let's take this 5-year-old seriously.
Right. Finally, the asking to be a killer whale or a locomotive had worn off, and the only thing that was left was asking for a mandolin over and over again. They finally got one for me. And their interest was always Supplementary, which I think was a lot of people that I talked to who grew up playing music, from as early an age as I did. Mm-hmm. I hear sometimes, just a tinge of resentment about their parenting, about the parenting that they experienced. Sometimes you could have stage parents or tennis parents or
you can have Joe Jackson.
yes, right. but in my case, my folks were always their interest was purely supplementary, and whatever I put into it, they also put in, but not more, mm-hmm. And certainly not less.
Okay.
And they would hold me accountable for some goals that I would state. I want to enter this contest, and they might say, "Oh, well, you should probably practice for it, right?"
Yeah.
And I go, "Oh, okay." and then 6 hours later, I realize my hands hurt a little bit.
Take us back to 2014 for the 25th anniversary of Nickel Creek. How much did that moment mean to you, and was the longevity of the group beyond your imagination?
Oh, for sure. The people were still interested in hearing our stuff, or actually, paid attention to that record that we made, sort of in honor of that anniversary. You certainly don't want to feel like you're throwing a party for yourself.
No one does.
And we didn't. Which was amazing. I think we had been away from it long enough to rediscover a love for some of our old material that maybe we
Absolutely.
Were anything but loving towards the end of our initial run. And so that was nice. I think in a way our listenership gave us our own material back. That we had sort of vilified some of that early material as just being from a time that we were not comfortable with, or that we felt awkward. It's like sometimes playing one of those old songs is like having to look at a picture of yourself during like the most awkward phase of your adolescence.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
And I think it's easy to forget. I forget that about maybe my favorite artists. Why won't Radiohead play Electioneering off of OK Computer? What a great song. And forget my own experience with that, of like, man, that could be like those guys looking at themselves with a mouthful of braces and baby fat still there and clothes that don't fit and et cetera, et cetera.
Stop it. It's high school again.
Yeah, exactly.
So step away from bluegrass for a second. If you could cross over into any other genre, what would it be?
Well, I kind of don't feel much separation in between any of them, or the separation that exists strikes me as being largely arbitrary.
Okay.
Sort of texture, like almost as if you were to separate books. They say don't judge a book by its cover, and I think largely genre is judging a book by its cover. That it's taking the look of something, or that it's treating that as if it's very, very important, that the instruments on which it's played is its defining characteristic.
Yeah.
And to me, that is just simply not the case. I think the notes with which it's constructed, that's what defines it. And you'll find, so in Western music, you'll find that it's all the same 12 notes. In other various forms of music, you might find that it's the same 24, or that's certainly an interesting difference of like, mm-hmm. Ooh, well, they have twice the notes that we have. What's up with that? Why do we have so few? but I do think that at its core, great music is very similar to itself.
Yeah.
And that the things that cause us to separate it into various genres are just aesthetics. And so I just don't feel very separate. So the textural aesthetic gets developed to the point where I just don't think it matters that much.
Yeah.
What instruments you're playing.
I love that response. Chris, thanks so much for your time on today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
That was Chris Thiele, mandolinist, MacArthur Fellow, multiple Grammy Award winner, and host of A Prairie Home Companion.
Check out the new album, Chris Thiele and Brad Melda.
Buddy, I went down to Scarlet Town, ain't never been here before. You slept on a feather bed and I slept on the floor. Honey, I don't mind, I mean no time, or drinking my coffee cold. But the things I seen in Scarlet Town did mortify my soul. I look at that deep well, I look at that dark grave, ringing that iron bell in Scarlet Town today.
For many in South Louisiana, flooding is a part of daily life. You buy flood insurance, plan ahead, have a place to stay if there's a big hurricane. But the floods this summer in and around Baton Rouge took a lot of people by surprise. Many of them had moved away from the coast after previous storms and never thought it would happen there. Donald Hebert is one of them. His house in Denham Springs took a foot of water. He went to Madisonville with family. It was the fourth time he's had to move due to flooding. His grandson, Jock Hebert, sat down to ask him what's changed in those decades and how he's navigating his options now.
I wanted to talk to my grandfather because growing up, I had always heard the stories of storms that had affected he and my grandmother in their lifetime. Over the course of his lifetime, he's been affected by four storms, mainly while they lived in Plaquemines Parish, where he moved after college and married my grandmother, whose family had been there for quite a while. And, you know, this has been such a focus in some ways of his life, of what he's gone through, that I just wanted to sit down and understand how he's been able to get through it and also what lessons he could give me as someone living in coastal Louisiana.
Well, I guess tell me about the first storm you lived through, and I guess it was down there in Plaquemines Parish. Was it Hurricane Flossie in 1956?
We had just, when we first got married, we built a garage apartment. And then after our son was born, and he got a little older, we built a house in Point LaHache, and we lived in it for less than a month when the Flossie came along. And of course, Flossie took the house. The back part and the lower side were gone.
So you lived in that house for a month before it was destroyed by a storm?
Yes.
It was a really hard time for my grandparents. They were just starting out in their marriage. Their house was completely destroyed. They had to rebuild without much help from anyone, and they did. I mean, they've rebuilt in Point LaHache because that's where my grandfather had to be for his job, and they lived there for another 9 years until Hurricane Betsy again destroyed their house. After about a few years, they decided to move further north to Braithwaite, where they thought they would be better protected and, you know, safer from storms. And they were for a while, actually about 40 years until 2005, when Hurricane Katrina again destroyed their house. And then Rita, a month later, flooded it.
What happened in Katrina?
Well, Katrina, we had, what, the water 1 foot from the ceiling. We had furniture that was in the bedrooms wound up in the garage. We had furniture that was in the living room, the den, wound up in the dining room. We had furniture all over the place. That and it was funny. We had a curio cabinet that was there at your grandmother. Had angels, ceramic angels, in the curio cabinet. And it was next to a desk, and then the other side was a big television, and we had also a radio stereo combination, big one. And all that stuff was all over the place. It was upside down. And some of it, like I said, in the garage. Some of it, the bedrooms, we had stuff from the bedrooms had wound up in the den, and that curio cabinet stayed right where it was with all the ceramic angels as though it hadn't been, it wasn't touched. But everything else was there. It was all over the place.
And you still have those angels?
Oh, yes, yeah, still have them.
It's funny that all the things you think are more fragile have survived.
Yes. Yeah.
The stuff that seems like it's easiest to break, it's still here.
Yeah, well, that's just one of those things.
After Katrina, my grandparents decided it was enough. They moved to Denham Springs. They couldn't go through another storm.
And then when you were in Denham Springs, you thought you were better protected, that you didn't have to worry about this again.
Yeah.
What was it like, you know, being in a place where you thought you were safe, but then being flooded?
Well, I said, here we go all over again. So it's something that you couldn't help. I don't care where you go somewhere in this country, you're going to have some problems. We just happen to have this type.
What's it like to have gone through this four times? I mean, what were you thinking when what was going through your head?
Like I said, not again. The only good thing about it is that we've got flood insurance.
I lived outside of the state for about 10 years, and I moved back because this is home. My grandparents instilled in me a love for this place, and I wanted to be back here. Growing up in Plaquemines Parish, I loved hearing the foghorns from the boats on the river and riding my bike on the Mississippi River levee. I now live in Holy Cross in New Orleans, where I can still hear the foghorns, and I still ride my bike on the Mississippi River levee. It's as close to Plaquemines Parish as I can get.
What do you see as the future for your grandchildren, like me, your great-grandchildren? Do you, you know, hope that they have a future here in Louisiana and on the coast?
Well, yes, I do. The only thing is I'm not going to be around to see it, whatever happens.
Do you think it's worth staying on the Louisiana coast?
If the coast keeps disappearing like it is, you might have to move a little farther north. But, like I said, Louisiana's home.
That's why I moved back.
It was really meaningful to have this conversation with my grandfather. He has been through so much in his life, had so many struggles, and he's still here. You know, he survived them, and he didn't have, you know, all the choices that I have in my life. I can choose to live elsewhere. He had to be here, but I choose to be here because I love it. It's home, and I commit my life to working to build support for coastal restoration so we can save as much of Louisiana's coast as possible. And for those of us who love it and want to be here, we have to make choices that are going to allow us to be here, you know, 50, 100 and more years into the future.
That was Jock Hebert interviewing his grandfather, Donald. Support for WWNO's Coastal Desk comes from the Greater New Orleans Foundation, the Koi Poo Foundation, and the Walton Family Foundation.
Nonprofit organization is setting out to heal a somewhat broken relationship between police and community. Here's John Barnes, founder of Right the Wrong Together, and Sherry Green, director of PR. Let's start by asking about RTWT.
Right the Wrong Together is a nonprofit organization that tries to bridge the gap between law enforcement and the community. It's basically re-educating both sides on how to deal with one another. Basically teach them what it feels like to put that uniform on. It's a 50% chance you may not make it back home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And every officer out there, they're out there to do a job and return home safely to their families. But also, on the other side, we're trying to teach law enforcement that just because you're in law enforcement doesn't mean that you are better than everybody, or just because you have that power, you can abuse it and treat people in a certain way. Mm-hmm. They have to understand what it feels like being like a regular citizen as far as dealing with people with respect and dealing with them and letting them know that, hey, just because I'm in a power position doesn't necessarily mean that I gotta abuse it. But also, I want that in return.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do, is trying to get people to respect each other.
Right. Now, John, this is interesting because you actually work in law enforcement. What encouraged you to start this nonprofit organization?
I just got tired of, while in law enforcement, doing everything I possibly can do to not arrest someone or take them to jail. And it was the level of disrespect that I was getting. And I tried my hardest to respect the person or respect the citizen. And I just did not get the level of respect that I was trying to get. Mm-hmm. And then sometime it end up in a not so good situation. But that's not what I personally was shooting for. I wanted to just neutralize the situation. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So with that being said, I understand coming from the community is not having that respect. What I'm trying to do is wipe the slate clean and we can start all over.
Mm-hmm. Could you possibly say that you saw that trying to happen post-Katrina? Because prior to that, you know, the NOPD was looked at somewhat as a corrupt department. So do you think that stems from that?
I would say me just being a citizen and then being in law enforcement. I can't speak for other officers or other community members, but it's what I feel in my heart. Before Katrina, yes, we had a lot of problems in law enforcement, but we had a lot of problems everywhere in law enforcement and in the community as well. So basically, I'm just trying to get everybody on the same level.
Sherry Green, you're the director of public relations. In that position, what response have we seen from the community in regards to this nonprofit organization, Right the Wrong Together?
The organization is in its infancy. We're in the beginning. So we're just now starting to get the word out about what we're doing, about what John's doing, and what we're trying to establish in the community. And by doing that, we have an event coming up in February at the Jazz Market called our Unity in the Community event to try to bring law enforcement and the community together in a peaceful environment and start that conversation.
Now, you guys mentioned that Right the Wrong Together is in its infancy. However, John, what response are you expecting from people that you work with in law enforcement?
That's a good question. I look at it like this. If you're that type of officer, you care about your job and you care about the community, yeah, and you care about where you are patrolling, then you wouldn't have a problem. You should run to it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not, then stay where you're at. Mm-hmm. But I don't need negative people, whether it's in a community or law enforcement. This is a positive organization. We're trying to do a positive thing, and that's what I'm looking for.
Okay. Sherry, again, that event
at the People's Health New Orleans Jazz Market from 6 to 9. We're going to have some exciting things going on. We have a band that's going to be there. We're raffling off tickets, 4 tickets to the stands at Gallia Hall on Mardi Gras Day. We're going to also auction off a coveted Muses shoe that you can get without going to the parade, if you bid on that, which is very very rare. We're also auctioning off an amazing cigar package that's being donated to us by Cigar Church.
Also, I just wanted to add to the band.
Yes,
the name of the band is called Bean in a Band, and the reason why I'm saying that, because we have some of the band members that will be donating their time to us. So I do want to give the recognition to them for helping us out.
Correct.
With this event.
Yes.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. That was John Barnes and Sherry Green, founder and director of PR. For more information, visit rtwtus.org. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans, here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.